Time now is 7 o'clock.
Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm Ethan Elkind. Our topic this hour is Trump's budget proposal, California braces for deep environmental cuts. The budget proposal released by the Trump administration earlier this month outlines deep and unprecedented cuts across many federal agencies. At the top of the list is the Environmental Protection Agency, slated for a 31% cut, as well as cuts to other programs like transit that affect the environment. Now, congressional review will likely temper the depth of the cut to the EPA and other environmental work at the federal level, but the proposal sends a strong message to constituents and raises an alarm for environmental advocates. In California, a state known as an early adopter and innovator in environmental policy and clean energy development, legislators, environmentalists, and concerned residents are watching closely. Notably, the budget calls for the elimination of about 3,200 EPA staff positions. Now, that's over 20% of the department's workforce. Among other things, California relies on the EPA to enforce Superfund site cleanup and to regulate the environmental impacts of interstate commerce. The budget would eliminate all funding for enactment of the Clean Power Plan, which an executive order tomorrow is likely to direct that it is overturned, and we'll talk about that during the show. It would also eliminate funding for $4.8 million earmarked to restore the San Francisco Bay, and it would also discontinue funding for climate change research and international climate change programs. Now, even if Congress pushes back, a reduced EPA will still have huge and far-reaching impacts across many industries. So how will California maintain its position as an environmental leader during a Trump administration? What strategies can environmental leaders employ to prepare for these possible rollbacks? What kind of impact could this have on your communities, those of our listeners? And how can private citizens engage and respond to these changes? So joining me in the studio tonight to discuss these issues are Jared Blumenfeld. Jared was the regional administrator of the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency under President Obama, and he spent two decades on the front lines of environmental protection, working to create meaningful benefits for communities and ecosystems alike. And Jared recently returned from hiking the full length of the Pacific Crest Trail from Mexico to California, so hopefully we can discuss that as well. Welcome, Jared.
Thank you.
And we're also joined by Ann Nothoff. She is a director of California advocacy at the Natural Resources Defense Council. She's led NRDC's efforts to get many of California's nationally significant environmental laws enacted. She's currently a Senate appointee to the State Coastal Conservancy and was a member of the board of the California League of Conservation Voters for more than 20 years. Welcome, Ann.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And also joining us over the phone, we have Michael Wara. He's a research fellow at the Program in Energy and Sustainable Development in Stanford's Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies, a faculty fellow at the Steyer Taylor Center for Energy Policy and Finance, and a center fellow at the Woods Institute for the Environment. Welcome, Michael.
Thanks for having me on, Ethan.
Great you can be here. And we invite you, our listeners, to join our conversation by dialing 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134, and we'll open the phone lines up in about 20 minutes. Or you can email us now at cityvisions@kalw.org, or post a comment on kalw.org or on our Facebook page. And so now on to the discussion. So Jared Blumenfeld, I wanted to start with you. Since you were someone who had to be responsible for operating a regional branch of the EPA, what was your reaction when you saw these proposed cuts coming out of the Trump administration to the EPA budget?
First of all, thank you, Ethan, for covering. It's a great topic and very timely, as you said, with the president going to EPA to make some pretty disastrous decisions and announcements tomorrow. Really, unfortunately, it didn't come as much as a surprise. Trump, the candidate, said he wanted to get rid of EPA. You know, Scott Pruitt, the person he put into EPA, is someone that has forcefully fought against the agency. So he installed, as the head of EPA, someone who wants to destroy the agency. And this budget really does that. This isn't, I think a lot of us believed it would happen slowly, it would happen stealthily, but this is a full frontal attack designed to dismantle EPA completely, and that's really what it's doing.
And so from a typical Bay Area resident perspective then, what are the on-the-ground impacts of these potential cuts? And we know they haven't gone through the congressional process yet, but just knowing that this is where the Trump administration is starting from, how would this affect the average person's life in the Bay Area?
So often we take EPA for granted. It was founded in 1970, really because of California, the Clean Air Act actions in LA with the smog and all the issues that happened in coastal California in 1969 with the Santa Barbara oil spill. Many, many things led to the creation of EPA. And it underpins everything that we see, the great work that's being done by Jerry Brown, the work that's being done in all our cities and counties. That work lays on a foundation, and that foundation is the statutes and the work that EPA does. So whether it's the Clean Air Act or the Safe Drinking Water Act, those standards, the science to work out, is the water that comes out of your tap fit for drinking? That work needs to be done. It needs to be done day in, day out. There are laboratories across the country that are going to be defunded in this budget. There are people that go out and do that monitoring every day. The same is true of surfers and beaches. California has more surf days than any other state in the union. But how do you know the water's fit? Mm-hmm. The way you do that is science. That science takes time and money and energy. It then needs to be put on websites. At the moment, there's pretty much an across-the-board blanket gag order on EPA. So even information that is being gathered isn't getting out to the public. So this is you know, I think Annie and I both worked in nonprofits before, and there's been times when we've called wolf, and it has been extreme. We lived through Reagan and Bush administrations, but this really is the wolf coming out. And this is the time to ring the bells and make sure that people clearly understand the dramatic impacts it will have day in, day out to Californians.
And so if this work isn't done, if the science isn't being monitored here and the information is not given to the public, I mean, what are the consequences? Can EPA just simply ignore its statutory duties that it has to enforce and monitor these environmental laws and issues?
The reason the budget is such a powerful tool is that if he went to Congress and said, I want to dilute the Clean Air Act or the Clean Water Act, you'd have a massive fight on your hands, and he'd likely lose. The budget, on the other hand, basically pulls the rug out from under people. You can't do that work, that basic primary science, if you don't have scientists on the payroll. You can't get it processed in the lab. There's one in Richmond, California, just across the bay, if you don't have the lab technicians, and you can't put it on the website so that the public and decision makers can be informed if you have no one in public affairs. So he's basically gutting the agency from the inside out, and it will leave it hobbling.
Mm-hmm. So Ann Nothoff, you're with NRDC, you're directing the California advocacy efforts here. What do you see from a state perspective that we need to be prepared for from the Trump administration, and what steps is the state taking now to try to deal with these proposed cuts and other environmental policies coming out of the administration?
Well, you know, the morning after the election, the leaders of California's state legislature and the governor issued very strong statements saying that they are committed to continuing California's leadership when it comes to environmental and civil rights and immigrant rights and the progressive values that have really characterized California's legal and our laws for the last several years. So California's ready to fight. I think what Jared's talking about, though, is very insidious, because this is a backdoor attack that the Trump administration is trying to take, because they know they couldn't win even in this Congress. I don't think that it would be very hard for them to undo the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act, because actually even the voters who voted for Trump for president didn't vote for dirty water and dirty air. I mean, we've done a number of surveys since the election, and it's Trump voters, they register in the 60s that still want to make sure that their kids aren't drinking unhealthy water and they're not going to have more asthma attacks during the day. So I think that is one of our challenges, is to kind of get the word out there that you can just have you can attack these programs just on a starvation diet.
And So I know you deal with state-level policy,
right.
But what's your sense at the federal level for this budget? What are the prospects for this budget actually coming out through the congressional process and looking like it does now? Do you think that these proposed cuts are likely to be carried out at some degree?
Well, I think we've already heard some grumbling and questions. You know, I think one of the quotes on the Senate side that it was this budget was dead on arrival. And certainly what we saw on Friday with the failure to put together a majority on health care, I think holds some lessons that we can look at for this budget as well. You know, here in California, there are 7 Republican members of the House of Representatives who were elected in districts where Hillary Clinton won in November. So that gives you a sense of how there could be folks in the majority in the House of Representatives that are, you know, they got to listen to their constituents. And constituents are speaking up very loudly in support of clean air and clean water, and particularly in California on climate action. You know, California is a first adopter of a lot of landmark environmental and energy programs. And I think that climate in particular, as we're going to see tomorrow when Trump tries to change the subject in Washington with a new attack on climate, I think we're going to see a very strong response from California, as we did just on Friday when the Air Resources Board recommitted itself to California's clean car standards. And we can talk about what that means for the rest of the country.
Yeah, we should definitely discuss that. But I'm just curious, from an organizational standpoint at NRDC, are there certain priority things that you would like to see the state do to safeguard its environment in light of where the Trump administration is signaling that it's going?
Well, yes, California has already really hit the mark on several of these. But for one, going to court, you know, the Attorney General from New York and the Attorney General from California and other states have already gone to court to uphold environmental and energy laws. And I think we're going to be seeing the Trump administration in court a lot. NRDC has been filing lawsuits since January 20th, and are going to continue to do that. And I think, I don't know if you want to talk about the climate, the clean power plan yet, but, you know, it took several years of research, science, public process to come up with the Clean Power Plan, and it's going to take several years for the Trump administration to dismantle it. Mm-hmm. Could be the rest of his term that's mm-hmm. going to take him to do this, because there are very strong, we have the law and we have process on our side.
And for those listeners, the Clean Power Plan is the Obama administration's effort to try to reduce greenhouse gas emissions from the electricity sector. And on that subject, since we're talking courts and the legal system, I'd like to go to Michael Wara down at Stanford. Thank you for joining us by phone, Michael. Curious what you think, from an environmental perspective, where the greatest risks are of what the Trump administration is proposing when it comes to the environment. What should keep an environmental advocate awake at night in California, based on what you're seeing from the Trump administration?
Well, I think the first thing to say is that it's a little bit unclear what the Trump administration really wants. They clearly want to give less money to the EPA, but I think rule number one for negotiations, and I think Trump is, you know, if nothing else, going to adopt these kinds of stratagems in his work in Washington, is ask for more than you expect to get. Mm-hmm. And that way you can settle for something that seems reasonable, redefine what seems reasonable. And I think part of the budget proposal at EPA is that part of its objective is really to redefine the reasonable outcome. Mm-hmm. And I'm hopeful that we can push back very hard against this kind of outrageous proposal and land somewhere closer to where we are now rather than, or where the 2016 budget was, rather than the proposal that he put forward. Mm-hmm. I think the biggest points of vulnerability for California really have to do with California's special permission to do more when it comes to vehicles. And Anne mentioned this just prior, and you referred to it as well, Ethan, that we have special authority under the Clean Air Act because we acted first and because our air pollutions our air pollution problems that are caused by cars and other vehicles are so severe to impose our own standards. And we've used that power quite effectively both to fight traditional air pollutants and greenhouse gases. And the Trump administration appears ready to try to roll back that authority to at least to some degree. We don't really know how much yet, but they're certainly making noises that suggest they want to try to limit California's authority to do more. And I think that would have a pretty dramatic effect both in the short term and in the long term, because it's going to change the rate of technological innovation in the vehicle sector, which is so important for protecting public health in the state.
That does seem like one of the most important areas, just thinking about all the driving that happens in California and the smog that results. So knowing that there is likely to be this push to revoke California's sovereignty to exceed federal standards on transportation emissions, how likely do you think it is that California would have success in the courts if it comes to that?
Well, my hope, I think in the long run, EPA has the right to redefine reinterpret its statutes, and really that would be the move that EPA would be most likely to make, reinterpret how they view this special authority that California has. But I think the long run can be very far away if California is an effective advocate in the courts, and it might well be that we never get there because the Trump administration is over before we reach that end point. And I'm hopeful that California can be a really effective advocate in other states that really benefit from this privilege. Of course, it's not just California that benefits from this special permission. Other states can opt into California's rules, and many states do. So this isn't just a California fight. It's really a multi-state fight to preserve this special authority to have clean air. The other place I think that's really significant is really has to do with the funding for water pollution and the reality of how the EPA's budget actually works. Many people might think that EPA is kind of this agency that spends all the money that it takes in, but the reality is that EPA, to a significant degree, is really kind of a middleman between the federal taxpayer and states and local governments, and that it funds enormous amounts of work at the state and local level that is at risk under this budget. And that work ranges from things you mentioned like Superfund cleanup, but also just basic investments in infrastructure to clean up sewage so that sewage outfalls are releasing clean water into our rivers and streams. And those kinds of grant programs, I think, are really threatened by what the Trump administration is proposing to do. And frankly, they're underfunded as it is, right? Those programs are not adequately funded currently. And so the idea that we're going to wring further savings out of them is a little bit absurd and certainly not in anyone's best interest.
And Jared Blumenfeld, since Michael's bringing up this the EPA being underfunded anyways, is that something that you experienced during your time heading up the region out here in the West, that there was already a lack of budget for what you needed to do?
Yeah, so before there was Trump, there was a Republican Congress, and that Congress is the one that sets this budget, no matter which president's in office. And they cut the EPA budget by 25%. So when I started in 2009, 2010, there's about 1,000 people in an office. By the end, there's about 750. And you reach a point where you can't do more with less. You just end up doing less. And so, as you heard from Michael, there's two things happening at the moment. One is the decimation of, in his budget, 3,200 additional people he wants to fire at EPA. Then there's the programs that go to states and tribes. Tribes are particularly important. They are sovereign nations, and they get 100% of their environmental program money from EPA. There's 100 tribes in California that get that. And then there's all the things in California that are still issues that people don't talk about. So 9,000 people die prematurely in California every year from air pollution. There are 1 million people in California that today are not drinking water out of their faucet that meets federal levels. There's hundreds of miles of streams and rivers and lakes that don't meet federal standards. And there's 1 million trucks on the road that are polluting the entire state. So there's a lot to be done. It's very tempting to talk right about the waiver and those issues, and they are important, but they shouldn't overshadow the really meat and potatoes work that EPA does day in, day out to make sure that California and our environment are healthier. And unfortunately, you know, if you read the budget, you'd think things are rosy. Our environment's in great shape, Ethan. It's really time, you know, we don't need to spend as much money on that. We should spend money on other things. That, unfortunately, isn't borne out by the science. The environment is in trouble, and we need to spend much more time and energy on this issue.
And of course, it's easy for people to complain, for the public to complain, when EPA isn't moving as fast as it should be. And if you're dealing with budget cutbacks, you know, then that's sort of designed to frustrate people. So this is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at kalw.org. Tonight we're discussing the impact of the Trump administration's budget and policy proposals on California's environment. With our guests, Jared Blumenfeld, former regional director of the EPA under President Obama, Ann Nothoff, director of California Advocacy for NRDC, and Michael Wara, associate professor of law at Stanford University. We invite you to call in with any questions or comments, and we're opening the phone lines now. So the number to call to join this conversation is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. 841-4134, or you can email us at cityvisions@kalw.org, or post a comment on kalw.org or on our Facebook page. So, Ann Nothoff, I wanted to go back to you. I wanted to get your thoughts about Michael Wara's comments about likely litigation, the transportation issue in particular with cars and trucks, and California's ability to go beyond that. Where is NRDC on this issue of transportation emissions?
Well, certainly, you know, in California, the majority of greenhouse gas emissions come from the transportation sector. So we've been fighting greenhouse gas emissions from cars and light trucks for over a decade now. I think one of the hopeful things is the power of the market, that the size of California's market. You know, as Michael mentioned, when California adopts a standard for clean cars, Detroit and other places have to make cars that meet the California standards. And then there's another 12 states that also join with California. So that represents a third of all the cars in the country. And we've seen that manufacturers, whether they're manufacturing cars or they're manufacturing refrigerators or television sets, they don't want to make two sets of equipment. So they have been making it to meet the California standards. So that's really the power of the California market, regardless of what Trump and his polluting cronies want to do. California consumers can send a signal through the marketplace that they want to buy clean, more efficient refrigerators and cleaner cars. So that's one thing that Californians can do right now, and hopefully will tie up these weakenings in the courts long enough that people can continue to do that. We're also seeing that with clean energy, solar, wind. You know, the market has gotten to a point where it's pretty healthy on its own. We're going to test that because it's going to lose some of its supports from the federal government. But there's, you know, a lot of investments going forward. And I do think we're always at risks when the policies are in question, because that's hard for the investors to make investments there. But I think we've come a long way and gotten a pretty solid base in front of us.
Well, and I think about our electric vehicle program in California. Electric vehicle sales are, you know, starting to take off. You've got some new models coming out. Tesla's going to come out with their mass market electric vehicle. Do we here in California need to worry that some of the incentive programs, the tax credits, or the mandate that California has under the Clean Air Act, or is able to have under the Clean Air Act, to require automakers to build a certain number of and sell a certain number of electric vehicles, is that at risk? Is that something that you're looking at NRDC?
I think, yes, we are looking at those incentives, renewable incentives for renewable energy. As I said, I think we need to prepare that we're going to have to figure out how to supplement that or test the market to see how strong it is on that. So, you know, I think Californians have shown how through the marketplace what they want to buy, but we'll see. And I think that we already account for the majority of sales of clean vehicles.
Mm-hmm. And Michael Warr, I wanted to go back to you. We had talked briefly about the clean power plan that the EPA had proposed as a rulemaking, and I know it's tied up in the courts. What do you see from law school perspective as the future for the clean power plan now? And maybe for listeners, if you could just sort of describe some of the background on it, that might be helpful.
Sure. So the Clean Power Plan was, or is, I should say, until probably sometime in the future, maybe tomorrow, is a regulation that the Obama administration developed that really places the first limits on greenhouse gas emissions from all fossil-fueled electric power plants in the country, and that's a real transformation, and the Obama administration carefully crafted its regulation. It's a novel interpretation of the existing Clean Air Act, but I think they did a good job supporting that with an appropriate legal rationale and factual basis. And of course, there are lots of people that don't like the idea of regulating greenhouse gas emissions or even limiting greenhouse gas emissions in any way from power plants. And those people, including 26 states and a number of industry trade groups, challenged the rule. It's been in the courts. It's currently before the D.C. Circuit, and there are some quite complicated procedural maneuvers occurring there as the Trump administration is trying to essentially switch sides in the litigation, to move from being a defender of the rule to being on the side of the industry that's opposed to it. I think, realistic speaking in terms of the impacts in the world, I think most people at this point assume that the Clean Power Plan is not going to happen unless there is, unless and until there's a change in government in Washington. Mm-hmm. Now, I think it's important, though, to minimize or to emphasize the fact that that may not have as large of a consequence as we once thought, in the sense that the combination of the fall in the costs of renewable energy and the continued low natural gas prices in this country and the success of energy efficiency programs in the state, at the state level, kind of across the country, are driving dramatic transformation in this country's electricity system. Really transformation that we haven't seen really since we invented the electricity system at the dawn of the 20th century. And so I'm actually very optimistic about the power sector and its ability to change and the fact that it's going to change with or without regulation, because the economics and the business fundamentals and customer and consumer desires are driving that change.
Mm-hmm. But certainly the Clean Power Plan underlies our commitment internationally with the Paris Accords, which signed in 2015. Isn't the Clean Power Plan a big chunk of the U.S.'s commitment to reducing greenhouse gas emissions? And if so, does putting the Clean Power Plan on ice and they're eventually trying to kill it, what does that do internationally to the U.S.'s standing?
I think we are not on track to comply with the Paris Accord pledges. But to be totally transparent, we weren't on track prior to the election either, and we needed to deepen our commitment along a variety of dimensions in order to comply with the Paris Agreement. A Clinton administration would likely have done that. The Trump administration is obviously heading in the opposite direction. So I would say, from a Paris compliance perspective, This is a damaging move, and it's going to damage our international credibility on climate and on other related issues. And I think it's very interesting to see that Rex Tillerson, the Secretary of State, former CEO of Exxon, has emerged as a defender of the Paris Agreement, because he recognizes the linkage between that our cooperation on that issue, on the issue of climate on the international stage, and a whole variety of other issues which are important to the Trump administration.
And Nothoff, on the subject of Paris and California, where do you see things shaking
up? Well, I was just going to say that here's another place where California really matters, because actually starting with Governor Gray Davis and then really exploding with Governor Schwarzenegger, California was an international climate hero. Schwarzenegger really saw the power of California as a actor on climate during the Bush administration when there was nothing going on in Washington, D.C., and then certainly Governor Brown has taken that to the next level and even starting its own agreement with provinces and states and cities around the world to sign an agreement. It's called the Under 2 MOU, and so you've got places like provinces in China and India and major cities around the world signing on to say they're going to do their part to reduce greenhouse gas emissions with or without the Paris Accord. So, hey, California might be the only game in town for a while, but I think things are moving. And California is a big part of it.
So California may need its own Secretary of State at some point if the federal government's not leading internationally. This is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. Tonight we're discussing the impact of the Trump administration's budget on California's environment with our guest Jared Blumenfeld, former regional director of the EPA under President Obama, Ann Nothoff, director of California Advocacy for NRDC, and Michael Wara, associate professor of law at Stanford University. We invite you to call in with questions or comments. The phone lines are open, and the number to call to join the conversation is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or you can email us at cityvisions@kalw.org or post a comment on kalw.org or on our Facebook page. And it looks like we have someone on the phone lines, Karen from Berkeley. Karen, welcome to City Visions.
Oh, great. This is a great subject. So my pet peeve is the fracking industry in California gets to steal all fresh water from aquifers in their hydraulic fracking wells while they're pumping in hundreds of toxic, poisonous, and cancer-causing chemicals that they are exempt from disclosing to the public because the fracking industry is exempt from the Clean Air and the Clean Water Act, which are both federal programs. California is the only of 50 states that does not charge the fracking industry an extraction tax from stealing our water and our natural resources. So if we were to impose an extraction tax on the fracking industry, and don't forget they have a million wells all over the state and they are sucking our water dry. They are destroying the orange groves and all the farmers. All the water is being taken by a lot of it is being taken by the fracking industry. Mm-hmm. So if we can get the money from the fracking industry so that they pay their fair share of an extraction tax, we can use that to clean up the bay and to pay for all other types of programs. But right now, they are just thumbing their nose at us. They're taking everything for nothing, and they can pollute, and they're polluting their fracking wells.
Right.
Release methane.
I hate to cut you off, but I think you're raising a really important question, and I want to make sure our panelists have a chance to respond. So, Jared Blumenfeld, you were at EPA. What is your response to Karen's complaint here about the fracking industry and its impact on water supplies in particular?
So, Karen, thanks for the question and for the passion behind the question. I think this is exactly what we need to be focusing on. It's local issues that get people irate, that they're like, why the hell is this happening in my neighborhood? The problem is when the issues get so far away and so obtuse that they're just in the halls in D.C., that's when the environmental movement loses. So Californian fracking, it's a big issue. Fran Pavley and others that Annie has worked with up in Sacramento have passed legislation, but you're right. You know, in terms of taking precious freshwater resources, it is a huge drain on that. And when I was at EPA, we investigated the state of California over the fact that they hadn't gotten exemptions from EPA under the Safe Drinking Water Act to put that dirty water back in the aquifers. So it is an issue. I think really the benefit in California is that the regulators are looking. They do care. They have accountability from people like you. Whereas if you go to other states in the union, EPA plays a much bigger role. And so these cuts will have a much bigger impact. It will go from some oversight of fracking around the nation to places where they're very friendly to fracking, where you'll have virtually zero accountability and oversight with EPA being gone. So it's a big issue. One thing that I wanted to raise, Ethan, in this context is this isn't just a cut to EPA. So the president's budget It cuts USDA, which plays a very large role, especially in California, by $4.7 million. So we had one of the most successful programs to clean the air in California was getting rid of old tractors, helping farmers buy new tractors. That program will be eviscerated. Department of Energy and all their innovation at places like Lawrence Livermore, all the work they do to help renewables and other technologies get started, they'll be cut by $1.7 billion. And the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration that does all the weather mapping, the climate modeling, they're being cut by $500 million. So this is an attack on the environment. This is an attack on science. It's an anti-science budget. It's basically saying we don't need science to help us make good decisions. We're just going to just allow the market to move forward. And you know what? Regulation's a pain. We hate regulation. And he's right, though. Regulation, when you speak to the average citizen, is clean water, clean air, and clean land. Without some form of environmental standards and accountability for those standards, you have pollution.
Mm-hmm. Well, another program, you mentioned some really important ones, DOE and U.S. Department of Agriculture. But there's also transit funding. And we just saw that a grant to electrify Caltrain from San Francisco down to Silicon Valley was suspended. This was a grant that had been approved to take Caltrain, which is currently diesel emissions, make that electric transport down there, speed up service, reduce emissions. So we're seeing different ways of that the environmental goals in California can be undermined through some of these cutbacks. And Nothoff at NRDC, are you tracking these transit issues? And if so, what do you see as sort of what we need to expect here in the Bay Area, given that we rely so much on federal dollars
right,
for
and
transit?
Absolutely. That's one of the things that Governor Brown was highlighting when he was in Washington, D.C. last week. And that is really, this is where we're going to test the Trump administration's commitment to rebuilding America and infrastructure development. That we've got a lot of infrastructure needs here we want to partner in the federal government. And California's big, but we do a lot of the things better when we have a partner that has some constructive approach. I think I was going to also mention one of the things that California leaders are doing is they're not just going to court, they're not just going to Washington, D.C., but they're proposing legislation here in Sacramento to hold the federal environmental and civil rights protections that we have whole. So when Jared's talking about the war on science, here in California we have a lot of research labs, whether it's the USGS down in Menlo Park or Lawrence Livermore or Berkeley Labs, and those scientists that are working in those labs have had this chilling, threat issued to them. And so, for example, there's a bill in Sacramento working its way through that would give employment protection to any employees of the federal government in those labs if there was any kind of retribution on them.
Whistleblower protection.
Right.
Yeah. And I remember the governor, of course, famously said after the election, we'll launch our own damn satellites if the Trump administration cuts back on the scientific monitoring.
So there's a couple of bills that would say that if we have Endangered Species Act protections now that are taken away, we're going to make those whole here in California. So we've done that before with when the Bush administration tried to change the Clean Air Act, and this is a more ambitious approach now.
Mm-hmm. So I wanted to thank Karen for that important question about fracking and go back to the phone lines. Ruth Ann, you're on the air. Welcome to City Visions.
Hi there. This isn't so much on Trump's impact on California, but I wanted to ask the guests their thoughts on methane emissions from meat eating and big ag, because big ag in California is almost as big as fracking and big oil.
Mm-hmm. No, it's a really important question.
The amount of water it uses and then the methane emissions from meat eating and meat production.
Absolutely. I think a lot of people don't realize how intensive our dairy industry can be in terms of inputs and pollution, and methane is a big part of that. Jared Blumenfeld, you worked, I assume, with some dairy issues. What do you make of methane and the emissions from meat production in California in particular?
So, Ethan, they're really and the two big issues here. One is air pollution. So the the worst air pollution in the United States is in the L.A. Basin and in the San Joaquin. And in the San Joaquin, it's very fine particulate, and in L.A., it's ozone. And a lot of that fine particulate in the San Joaquin, when two things mix, emissions from vehicles or combustion and volatile organic compounds, which is also methane, those two things create pollution. So EPA spent a lot of time with farmers looking at how to reduce those dairy issues. And one of the ways is you put the dairy barns inside and you vent the whole system. Another big issue that the regional water quality control boards and EPA look at together is the pollution that comes from the runoff from these facilities. So, Karen, the last caller asked this question, and it relates to this. The Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, the Safe Drinking Water Act all have exemptions for ag, mining, and oil and gas. And so there's not that much that EPA can do. And this is a great example where EPA is hamstrung, but the state of California has enacted laws that are stricter than California. When they enact those, they become federalized, and it allows groups like NRDC to then go to federal court to make sure those laws are enforced. So it's a great question. My recommendation is one day a week, people go without meat.
Mm-hmm. So on that point, then, the extraction tax that Karen had mentioned, is that something that the state could viably do? Is that something you've looked into?
I mean, so in just in terms of the kind of direction of where we're at, the state of California does amazing work. When you think about 50 states, California is number one when it comes to the number of people, the level of sophistication, the level of science, the level of monitoring. But even with that great wealth in California, this will mean millions, hundreds of millions of dollars not going to California to do those programs. And it will mean California has to take money from other programs just to stay even with where it is now. But in the rest of the nation, it will mean those programs sink down in some places to zero. You'll have absolutely no work going on if EPA isn't doing it. And so California will be hurt simply because it's the largest state in the union. It gets the most amount of money, $300 million in total. So programs that I witnessed that were just being built out in small communities in the San Joaquin Valley, without that money, will not get built. That infrastructure commitment that the president pretends to have will not get realized if he cuts this money to EPA.
And those were a lot of his voters there in the Central Valley, mm-hmm. if not across California. I mean, not across California, but there in the Central Valley. Thank you, Ruth Ann, for that call. This is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. We're discussing the impact of the Trump administration's budget and environmental proposals on California's environment. We're joined by Jared Blumenfeld, former regional director of the EPA under President Obama, and Nathan of NRDC, and Michael Wara of Stanford University School of Law. We invite you to call in with questions. The number, again, is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Don't forget you can email us as well at cityvisions@kalw.org or post a comment on kalw.org or on our Facebook page. Michael Warr, I wanted to ask you, the subject of methane just came up, and this was also a subject of congressional action. There was a relatively obscure statute called the Congressional Review Act that Republicans in Congress have been utilizing, and I was wondering if you wanted to offer your take on how Republicans are using this act to invalidate environmental protections passed under in the last year or so, last 6 months or so of the Obama administration, and what you see might be happening with that going forward.
Sure. Well, it's used to be obscure, not so obscure anymore, unfortunately. The administration has shown itself, and Congress has shown itself willing to basically revoke regulations that were finalized at the end of the Obama administration. The Congressional Review Act allows that, and have used it to remove controls on methane emissions on public lands, from oil and gas extraction. That was a big move that they made. But I just want to make another point about methane, actually, which is I think this is a place where California is actually primed to lead in the country. You know, we, the Air Resources Board just adopted the other day some of the first regulations that will comprehensively regulate methane emissions in the entire oil and gas supply chain, sort of closing the gaps there. They just adopted a short-lived climate pollutant strategy that focuses on methane emissions both from the oil and gas sector and also from ag. This is actually a place where perhaps, you know, and then this is unfortunate for the rest of the country, but maybe not in the long run, California can step into the breach, create regulations that then become models for the rest of the country and eventually, hopefully, for EPA when it returns to its, you know, historic role of being a leader on environmental protection. You know, when that happens, we will have regulations that are tested and where we've learned how to do things right in California for methane emissions. And so I think that in some ways, this can be an opportunity for California to kind of shift perceptions of what is reasonable and appropriate for industries that are operating within our state, how they need to earn their social license to operate, and that view can then spread across the rest of the country in the long run. Mm-hmm. And certainly we saw that with climate. During the Bush administration, the country was unwilling to act on climate. Senator Pavley, Governor Schwarzenegger, and others took the lead, and in many ways, the result of that were the efforts at the federal level under the Obama administration to kind of federalize California policies. Mm-hmm. And I'm hopeful that we can make the most of this kind of dark moment, at least within California, to really shift perceptions of what is a reasonable approach to a lot of these issues, so that when we do have a more favorable Congress and president, we can really capitalize on that and spread those ideas out to the national audience.
So that the federal system and the states as laboratories of democracy. So something to look for environmental advocates. I want to go back to the phone lines. We have Aaron from San Francisco. Aaron, welcome to City Visions.
Thank you. Yeah, there have been previous questions about fracking, water, eating meat, and I'd like to ask about the building sector. Transportation was another. What's being done at the California level to introduce standards beyond LEED, say passive house or other ways of saving energy over the life of a building, and in terms of construction as well, because concrete is a huge user of energy, and are there things at the California level that can be done that could be replicated federally? Or what do things look like for the building sector and the energy over the lifetime of a building?
Well, why don't we throw that question to the Director of California Advocacy at NRDC, Ann Nothoff. You want to respond?
Sure, I'll take a stab. So thank you for the question. California is really ahead of the curve when it comes to building standards. And just in 2015, there was a bill passed in the legislature, SB 350, which actually directed California to double its building efficiency standards. So it's hard to believe when you look around the Bay Area, but 50% of the buildings in California that'll be here by 2050 have not been built yet. So that is a huge opportunity to increase efficiency and cut energy use, water use, and make what we've got go further. So California's really got energy building efficiency in its eyesight. I think, you know, if you combine power and electricity production, transportation and buildings, that's where you're getting your greenhouse gas emissions. So California is tackling all of those.
All right. Well, thank you, Aaron, for that important question, because certainly that's a way that you can save people money if you have more efficient housing and more efficient buildings. So I wanted to go back to Michael Warr. You had made a comment that I wanted to follow up on. You mentioned that you're very bullish about the power sector and that even without the Clean Power Plan, it looks likely that with reduced prices and solar panels and the like, that's a sector that we can expect emissions reductions anyways from. So is there anything you might worry that the Trump administration might do to undermine that progress? Or do you feel like it's sort of baked in terms of market forces pushing things like coal out and pushing up things like renewables?
Well, you know, ironically, the Trump administration is kind of a mutual contradiction when it comes to its policies in the electricity sector, where on the one hand they say, no, climate change isn't real and we're not going to regulate emissions. But on the other hand, they're pushing a number of the technologies, especially natural gas extraction through fracking, right, which has impacts that need to be mitigated. But that the impact of low natural gas prices is the death of coal in this country. And that is happening before our eyes, right? The Navajo Generating Station, one of the largest coal-fired power plants in the western United States, just announced that it's going to shut down, or it's seriously considering shutting down. That is an astonishing transformation that's really happened over the last 5 years. And part of the reason for that is low natural gas prices. Part of the reason is that these older fossil state units that have to come up to snuff on their environmental controls just can't compete economically with new wind and new solar resources. It's a combination of factors, but I do think that, and I should add, part of the reason is the new buildings that we're building that consume much less electricity and so are keeping demand from growing. And that's a story that really is a California story, mm-hmm. and one we should be very proud of as a state. Mm-hmm. But all those constellation of factors mean that the power sector is in the midst of a kind of wrenching transformation right now, mm-hmm. and we're going to see a lot of bankruptcies in that sector, and I think that's good, right? That's change. That is disruption happening before our eyes, mm-hmm. And so I am optimistic. I think the one risk factor is if for some reason the price of natural gas were to climb substantially, and unexpectedly, that could really throw a wrench into this process.
Yeah, it could make coal more competitive.
Absolutely.
So that's a helpful response. Thank you for that. I have an email question from Art from San Francisco, who asks, what are three local impacts of the EPA cuts that we will see in the Bay Area and when? And what are the three most important or effective things Californians can do to fight back against these cuts? Jared Blumenfeld, what do you see? What would you tell Art about three impacts that we're likely to see and what we can do about it?
So number one is Superfund. So the Superfund program is created to clean up the nation's most toxic facilities. And unlike all the other programs that we've discussed, it is run by EPA, not by the state, not by the locals. And when you cut money there, you see dramatic impacts in the speed of cleaning them up. It just so happens that Santa Clara County holds the record in the United States for the most Superfund sites of any county. And that's from the semiconductor industry and from the industrial rocket manufacturing after World War II. So what you see there is a lot of groundwater pollution, and the vapors go up into buildings where there are existing residents. Those residents want monitoring. Those residents want cleanup, and they're going to get less answers less quickly. So that's number one. Number two is we recently had an explosion at the Chevron refinery. All these large processes, whether it's anhydrous ammonia or chlorine or refineries, are regulated under a risk management program. Those are the things that would keep me up at night, the things that go bang in the night and have very serious impacts. That program's already been cut. They're now suggesting it be cut even further. So facilities that would have been visited once every 2 years will now be visited once every 10 years. So people that live near those communities, and those are environmental justice impacted communities, I think will feel it first. And then the third big area, I think, is enforcement. So EPA recently brought an action against East Bay cities, Oakland, Emeryville, Alameda, for discharging millions of gallons of untreated sewage into San Francisco Bay. Millions. That case would not have been brought. The case against VW would not have been brought if it was not for enforcement actions, independent actions by EPA and U.S. attorneys. So those things you will see go very quickly. The reason that the budget has such a chilling effect is that people that get close to retirement, people that just started with the agency are looking for a future in environmental protection. When your boss and that his boss, so Trump and Pruitt, both say, we want to get rid of this agency. This is what we think of the agency. We're going to cut its budget by 40% in most cases. You want to leave. So if you're that one expert that can clean up a toxic mess in San Jose and you're no longer there and there's a hiring freeze, it leaves a huge hole in public protection around the environment.
Mm-hmm. So we've only got a few minutes left, but I wanted to ask all of you for your take on what the average person can do who wants to respond to these proposals. So, mm-hmm. Ann Nothoff, why don't I start with you?
Well, I think speaking up works, and we've already seen that just in the last couple of months. So I think making sure that you are in close, regular contact with your representatives in Congress and with the representatives in the federal administration, I think they need to hear from folks, even if it's to say that that's a good job you're doing or object to some of the other things. I think also every day in your life you can choose to use less fossil fuel and eat more lightly on the land. So there's things that we can do as individuals as well as citizens.
Mm-hmm. And actually, we have a caller from San Francisco, Arian. Wonder if you could ask a question briefly in the last few minutes. Wanted to try to squeeze you in here. Are you still there?
It's about enforcement and regulation. Monsanto, who's made DPT and is now involved in the GMO industry, is also fabricating herbicides, and herbicides are being slathered on the tree stumps in the San Francisco parks, attempts to eradicate and ethnically cleanse eucalyptus. Okay. And I'm just wondering what the EPA is doing about that. Most people are opposed to GMOs.
Sure. I'm sorry to cut you off, but we're running out of time, so let me let Jared answer that.
Thanks, Ariane. I have the benefit of knowing a little bit about San Francisco's pesticide programs, and I can let you know that San Francisco was the first city in the nation to pass an integrated pest management ordinance, and that ordinance reduces the amount of pesticide and herbicide to levels lower than any city in the United States of America. So if you're lucky enough to live in San Francisco, you're lucky enough to be in a city that is using very, 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 very little of these toxic chemicals, just enough to kill, in that case, an invasive species.
So we're running out of time. I want to let Michael Wara have the last word here. And thank you, by the way, Arian, for that question. Michael Wara, real quick, what do you think is the thing? What would you recommend that the average person think of doing to respond to these proposals?
Well, I think I would just second what Ann said. Be in regular contact with your representative. If you like what they're doing, let them know that environmental issues and climate are important to you, because I think it's easy for these issues to kind of fall into the background, particularly given what else is at stake in the current legal legislative environment. The other thing I would say is to find out, if you don't know, if you do know, give them a call, who your state representatives are, and let them know that these issues are important to you, because there's a tremendous amount of important state legislation that is happening and that needs to happen on these issues to kind of backfill as EPA backs away. Mm-hmm. And this is an opportunity to get some of that done, but it requires input from citizens.
That's an important point. So thank you so much for that. That's City Visions for this evening. Our guest tonight were Jared Blumenfeld, former regional director of the EPA under President Obama, Ann Nothoff, director of California Advocacy for NRDC, and Michael Wara, law professor at Stanford University. Thank you all for joining tonight.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And for a link to this and other City Visions shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, and to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page on KALW.org. Our engineer this evening was Damian Miner. Tonight's show was produced by Judith Sansone and Wendy Holcomb. Next Monday, join guest host Grace Wan next Monday as we discuss the upcoming 50th anniversary of the Summer of Love. So you don't want to miss that one. This is Ethan Elkind. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great rest of your week.